Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He had been a five-star general, supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe in World War II, a national hero, a two-term Republican president. And 50 years ago today, in his farewell speech as President of the United States, Dwight D. Eisenhower warned against the kind of power that grew around the military he knew so well.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
Military-industrial complex. The phrase has echoed now for half a century, and the complex has grown. This hour on Point 50 years later, we look back at Eisenhower's speech and at the country's relationship with the military-industrial complex today. You can join the conversation. Have we heeded his warning? Have we succumbed to the danger he described? Will red ink and huge deficits rein in military spending as even peace has not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is James Ledbetter, editor of Reuters.com and author of the new book, Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. It's part of the Yale University Press Icons of America series. James Ledbetter, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Happy to be here.
We're going to dip in just a moment and hear a pretty good chunk of that speech. Set the stage for us. Here we are, 50 years ago today. Where was Dwight Eisenhower in the arc of his life, his thinking? Give us just a bit of background to help understand what we hear as we listen to a couple of minutes from the heart of that speech.
Sure. Well, this speech was delivered just a few days before the inauguration of John Kennedy. So Eisenhower had served out his two terms. He was only less than a decade away from death. He'd suffered a heart attack and a stroke. His speech delivery was never great, and was certainly not at the height of his speaking powers. And you'll hear him trip up a couple of times. But I think most importantly, he had seen at least since the launch of the Sputnik satellite in the fall of 1957, a kind of furor, a frenzy that had been whipped up around the idea of military spending. The Democrats in Congress made a huge deal out of Sputnik and a related so-called confidential report called the Gaither Report that purported to show that the United States had either fallen behind the Soviet Union in terms of its nuclear arsenal or was about to do so. This created a so-called missile gap that was a major issue in the 1960 election. Eisenhower knew for a fact that there was no missile gap, as the Kennedy administration quickly discovered, but he couldn't really talk about it because his knowledge was based on U-2 spy plane data that was, of course, top secret.
Wow.
So he was sort of sitting in great frustration watching for several years in the second term the Democratic Party in Congress and people very high up in the military kind of whipping up this furor about military spending based on facts he knew to be false. And I think that had a lot to do with his frustration, his sense that this machine of spending was something that was almost with its own momentum, something that couldn't be stopped even with the most powerful general of the century sitting in the Oval Office.
The most powerful general of the century, that he had headed Allied forces in Europe in World War II with all those battalions and you name it.
Right. Nobody had more military authority in the 20th century than Dwight Eisenhower, certainly not in this country, and yet he didn't feel as if he were in control of this massive spending machine. So I think that was a major factor in this speech. It should be said that he didn't come up with the idea himself. He didn't write the speech himself. It was written by two advisors, Malcolm Moose and Ralph Williams. However, as we now know, it went through several dozen drafts, and by the time he delivered it, it was very much his own idea, and the themes were very close to his heart. So it is a deeply felt expression of his point of view.
It's often described today as one of only two really memorable presidential farewell addresses in American history, George Washington's way back in the day, and Dwight D. Eisenhower's on January 17th, 1961, 50 years ago today. James Ledbetter, stand by. I want to give our listeners, this is a full couple of minutes from the heart where you can hear the context around his famous, now famous, reference to the military-industrial complex. Sit back, listen. We're in the Wayback Machine here 50 years ago today from Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address to the nation.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Dwight D. Eisenhower from his presidential farewell address, January 17th, 1961, 50 years ago today. James Ledbetter is with us. His new book is Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. Jim, I mean, that language just leaps out. It is not the kind of language that presidents use today, talking about the economic, political, even spiritual consequences of the interests that he's describing there. And this very interesting tension. I mean, here's the president. He's saying we, and I guess that includes him, recognize the imperative need for this development, this huge industry, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. There seems a tension even within his speech, in his view of what he's describing, Jim.
Absolutely. And, you know, that tension is sort of baked in to the very idea of a farewell address from Dwight Eisenhower. Remember that when Eisenhower came into power in early 1953, the United States nuclear arsenal was approximately 1,000 warheads. By the time he gives this speech, it's something like 23 or 24,000 warheads. So the bulk of the American buildup in the Cold War, certainly the fastest pace of it, took place on his watch. And he's aware of that, and certainly he signed off on it. But I think he, particularly in the second term, began to really reconsider the ramifications and the kind of crazy logic that the Cold War implied.
But what did he really want Americans to take away from it? Because he's giving this message. He's saying, on the one hand, we've got to have this. On the other hand, you know, watch out for its economic, political, even spiritual consequences. I mean, it can sound almost like Noam Chomsky right there, but he's still saying we've got to have it. So what are you supposed to do with that as a citizen?
There is an element of resignation in this speech. There is an element of admission of failure, particularly toward the end where he takes credit for not putting United States ground troops into conflict throughout his eight-year presidency, which is, you know, you look at most two-term presidents in the United States history, that's quite an accomplishment. But at the same time, he recognizes that this brutal machinery had been built in order to combat an enemy, and he wanted us to take seriously its implications. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, this is – remember that the president is the commander-in-chief. It is exceedingly rare in the history of American presidential rhetoric to get this kind of deep criticism of the implications of the military. Most presidents would prefer to ignore it, even if they saw it. I don't think they'd want to call attention to it because it is such a thorny and difficult problem.
Did this make a splash at the time, James, or is it only in the decades since that it's grown and grown, and especially with the tensions built into it? The general thing is.
This is a great question. In the immediate aftermath, which is to say that the next few days, there was coverage in the major newspapers. But remember, the Kennedy inauguration, which was 3 days later, basically bulldozed over most of the attention that could possibly have been focused on this speech. However, you begin to get in 62, 63 pockets of the society paying very close attention to this speech. For example, the Port Huron Statement, the sort of founding document of Students for Democratic Society, has an entire section devoted to the military-industrial complex, citing Eisenhower and looking particularly at something he didn't say in this speech, but was very much on the mind of his advisors, and that is the idea of a revolving door, the idea that junior naval and army officers retiring at age 45 suddenly take, you know, major positions on the boards of or on the staffs of big military contractors and then are in a position to be selling weapons to the very departments that they used to head.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Dwight D. Eisenhower's warning 50 years ago today against the military-industrial complex and how that complex shapes our lives today. James Ledbetter joins us from New York. His new book is Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. Also with me in the studio now is Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, author of Washington Rules and the Limits of Power. His big article in the current issue of The Atlantic is titled The Tyranny of Defense, Inc. Andrew Basevich, welcome back to the show. Thanks very much for being here.
I'm glad to be with you.
The Tyranny of Defense, Inc. would seem you're suggesting that the military-industrial complex still echoes strongly. Do you think you understand that phrase today, that we understand that phrase today as President Eisenhower understood it in 1961?
I think in some respects the president understated the problem, at least to restrict ourselves to a phrase like military-industrial complex today defines things too narrowly. There are elements in academia. There are churches. Certainly there exists a cadre of public intellectuals, all of whom are committed to perpetuating exceedingly high levels of military spending, all of whom in some way or another engage in the sort of threat inflation that James Ledbetter referred to when he talked about missile gap, bomber gap.
Right.
So it's much more than simply a military-industrial complex.
James, how do you see the president having understood these words? He didn't write them, but he came to own them, you tell us. He was a Kansas Mennonite before he was a five-star general. What were the influences at work in Dwight Eisenhower's mind, do you think, as he embraced this in this big speech?
I think it's important to remember, and I discussed this at some length in Unwarranted Influence, that especially in the second term, Eisenhower began to really rethink the idea of nuclear weapons and what spending on nuclear weapons was doing to American society. In the beginning of his administration, he rather famously said, "I don't see any reason why we shouldn't use nuclear weapons the same way you would use a bullet." He began to recognize through several conflicts that this was no longer the case and that something to do with scale, again, the tremendous buildup that took place under his administration, had changed the situation. And so he began, if I may use this term, to sort of fantasize about what a world would look like without the strong conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States. For example, he thought rather seriously about a massive student exchange program in which tens of thousands of Americans and Russians would trade place for a year. This was shot down by any number of advisors as impractical, but he took it seriously. Maybe a little less seriously, he thought about a worldwide plebiscite in which everybody in the world would vote. Would you rather be ruled by communism? Would you rather be ruled by liberal democracy or capitalist democracy? That was never going to happen, but I think he was forcing himself to think about the future of America when maybe this conflict would go away. And I think he took that idea very seriously, even if in the frustration of day-to-day administration of his office and in political battle, he couldn't achieve it.
There was, of course, an earlier speech, a famous speech, April 16th, 1953, in which he spoke to exactly that impulse, I guess, much earlier at the outset of his presidency, but he'd been a general already. And here he is talking about what it costs a society to maintain such a large military.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities.
And he went on to talk about, you know, here's what military arms cost and here's what they might buy instead. Instead of guns, we could have power plants and hospitals and bushels of wheat and homes for people. And that was very early in his presidency. James Ledbetter, you heard Andrew Bacevich say military-industrial complex no longer really encompasses how wide the sort of bought-in population of this country has become. How do you assess, whether his warnings have come true or not? We'll put the same question to Andrew Bacevich, but how do you look out in our world today? Our very large spending, famously now than the rest of the world combined, on the one hand. On the other hand, conservatives will argue, well, but look, we've stood astrode, safely astride the planet all that time, and with peace at home, more or less. How do you assess whether or not his dark warnings have come true?
Well, I think there are a variety of ways of looking at it. One, you can look strictly at the levels of spending. At the time when Eisenhower delivered this speech, you really did have a very large portion of federal spending going to the military. And Dr. Bacevich referred to the role of universities, a huge amount of funding, much, much larger as a percentage of all university funding than is the case today. At that time, a huge amount of funding was coming from the federal government. And of that, basically two departments, the Atomic Energy Commission and the Department of Defense, universities really became attached to the military-industrial complex, starting
even more than now. And he talked about that
absolutely
in
percentage terms.
What about the percentage of GDP on military, of GDP overall compared to now?
It's lower today. Of course, some of this depends on how you define military spending. But it's using the similar yardsticks from today to then. It is lower today. It's up a little. It went down in the 90s and began to rise again after the attack of September 11th and has continued to rise since then. But I think there are other ways to look at it. Again, you referred when you mm-hmm. quoted from the speech to this idea that there are political, economic, even spiritual aspects to
Eisenhower-industrial
complex. Eisenhower said that. Mm-hmm. And I think if we think about that, the military-industrial complex is still very much with us. Very few of us can even remember a time when the country wasn't on a war footing, when the economy wasn't largely in a defensive capacity. So the idea that the military-industrial complex is tied to our very conception of peace, I think that's very much with it. And I'll make one more point, and that is that the idea of a military-industrial complex is itself somewhat outdated in the sense that we are no longer really an industrial society. I think we have to think of a military post-industrial complex. And there's no better piece of that than in yesterday's New York Times, the extraordinary report about this worm, this computer virus that apparently Israel and the United that apparently Israel and the United States planted into the Iranian nuclear program. I think we're going to see over the next several years a massive kind of buildup of our cyber warfare capacities. And so that all-encompassing idea of technology being roped into the military-industrial complex is very much with us.
Andrew Bacevich, so as you say, military-industrial complex may not be a sufficient phrase to encompass everything going on here now. On the other hand, the president then, President Eisenhower, nodded to just about as wide a palette as you can imagine, economic, political, even spiritual, he warned. You have to watch out on all that fronts. When you look at the way this perhaps mindset is almost better than complex at this point, though there are still interests, interwoven interests here, how do you see its full dimensions? I mean, if we want to be self-aware in the way that Eisenhower might have wanted us to be, what would we perceive?
Yeah, I think had the president invited me to edit his speech, I think I probably would have suggested some term other than spiritual. Yes, the implications go far beyond the political and economic realms. They are moral. They have to do with the way we see the world and the way we see ourselves. Referring to recent news this past week, the Chinese test flew their J-20 stealth fighter.
Mm-hmm.
It's as I understand it, it's a prototype. It's not an operational aircraft. There exists one of them,
mm-hmm.
not fleets of them.
Mm-hmm.
It was striking, the response that this test flight elicited from Washington and sort of from national security experts. And the response was, holy smokes, if they've got one plane that potentially may almost be as good as ours, then this poses an immediate challenge. This is a new emergency, and therefore there must be, in essence, a military response. Not, I don't mean military in the sense of let's go attack China.
But crank out more. What do they
crank
cost,
out
like
more.
$350 million a piece?
Crank out better.
U.S. stealth fighter bombers.
And I think that is emblematic of the way that this mindset has taken hold, and emblematic of the way that critical thought, the consideration of non-military alternatives, really gets crowded out of the public debate.
I want to bring our listeners in here and come back to you, James, but first to Nashville, Tennessee. David's calling. Hi, David, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Hi, what do you know, David?
During my recent visit to Afghanistan, what I saw seemed to be this self-perpetuating, the military-industrial complex seems to be so self-perpetuating. I'm seeing plumbers, electricians, all these civilian contractors making upwards of $250,000, $350,000, $400,000 a year. And if the numbers are still the same, the ratio is still the same, there are more civilians there than military, it's just amazing how much money is being funneled in to the war in Afghanistan.
David, what were you doing? You say visiting. Were you a civilian contractor? Were you in the service? Something else?
No, I was actually in the military, in the infantry, and in the larger bases there. It's just an incredible thing to see.
So that's an experience most Americans have not had. What do you take away from that? President Obama says we've got to do this. You've been there. Are we spending too much? Is there something going on other than national defense?
I don't want to say that I don't want to insinuate that there's something going on other than self-defense. It's intimidating, and it does make me question if there's not a better way to do it. I do want to be careful not to criticize my government, not to criticize the military, because those of us who do serve are doing it, we believe 100% for the right reasons. It's just, like I say, the whole self-perpetuating mechanism. I don't know if we were just to cut it off tomorrow, what kind of impact would that have on our economy?
Yeah, David, I appreciate your call. James Ledbetter, to you first. I mean, there's a U.S. serviceman back from Afghanistan saying he's okay, maybe we need to do it, but he's blown away by the expenditures he's seeing and the way it's woven in at that distance to the American economy. What are you thinking as you hear that in the light of Ike's speech, Jim?
I think he makes a great point. The role of private contractors has absolutely exploded over the last decade or so, to the point where, you know, by some people's calculation, at least a half of the war in Iraq is sort of being funded through these private corporations. And we saw certainly with the Blackwater case, places where the accountability that we expect from the American military is very, very foggy when it comes to these private contractors. And I think that you could hardly argue for a better case of the military-industrial complex in practice, because you have both the profit motive, right? People are now able, as this gentleman says, to make $400,000 a year. I guarantee you the people in the infantry are not making $400,000 a year. So there's the profit motive. And then there's this lack of accountability that is at the heart of Eisenhower's critique. So I think it's a perfect and disturbing example of the military-industrial complex in action today.
One more call right here. Buffalo, New York. Elin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. There's something that jumped out at me in the excerpt from Eisenhower's farewell speech that nobody really has touched on, and that's the statement that he made asking for an informed citizenry.
And not only informed, but he says alert and knowledgeable. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Correct. And you know what? I think we fall very short of what he hoped our citizenry would be.
And that was really the only kind of hope. He said only that can serve as a proper governor on this. Elin, I appreciate your call. Andy Vasevich.
Well, I think we're getting to the heart of the matter here. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no question that American infantrymen serving in Afghanistan believe in their heart and soul that they are doing the right thing. There's no question about that. But to me, the larger question is, given these expenditures, given these efforts, what do we get for our money? Do we get peace and prosperity? And one could make an argument that in the 1950s, we did get peace and prosperity. Today we don't. And that's why I think Lynn's really putting her finger on the essential point is that and Eisenhower, this is what Eisenhower was begging Americans to do, to wake up, to be alert, to fulfill the role of citizens of democracy and therefore demand accountability, not simply the accountability that would ensure that contractors aren't ripping us off, but the larger accountability of ensuring that our government was pursuing a path that, in fact, contributed to the well-being of our nation.
Are you saying the military-industrial complex is behind our economic problems today?
Well, I think it certainly is contributing to them. Again, James Ledbetter's point about we've moved from an industrial economy mm-hmm. to a post-industrial mm-hmm. economy, that hasn't happened because of the military-industrial complex. But if we consider these outlays, today in constant dollars, the United States is spending more on its military than at any time since World War II, more today than during the Cold War. Well, during the Cold War, we were facing the so-called evil empire.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we are facing people who run around carrying Kalashnikovs mm-hmm. in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the justification, what is the rationale for this level of spending? And again, what are we getting as a return? What are we getting for our money? Not much would be my answer.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Dwight D. Eisenhower's warning 50 years ago today about the military-industrial complex, his phrase, and how that complex shapes our lives today. James Ledbetter joins us from New York. His new book is Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. Looks at all the backdrop to that speech, all the influences behind this president who had been a five-star general, of course, a hero of World War II before going to the White House. Andrew Bacevich is with us as well, author of Washington Rules and the Limits of Power. His article in the current issue of The Atlantic is The Tyranny of Defense, Inc. Let's get a call right here. David in Orlando, Florida. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Didn't we win? The MI complex, we won. We beat the Soviet Union. That was the purpose. That what drove it. It's naive to say, after seeing the fall of the Soviet Union, after the collapse, that they were anything other than the most evil threat to the free world. It worked. That was its purpose. And compare that against the social spending through the Great Society programs, which failed. The highest poverty rate is right now. So we won. I think the MI complex, because I was part of it in the military and out, it's a very efficient way to operate. You have to be quick. And all the advances brought on by MI, Internet, extremely a large amount of telecommunications advances, came out of that. So we just can't look at it as totally negative as a threat. It worked. We won.
David, I appreciate your call. James Ledbetter, what do you say?
I agree in part with what David says. There's no question that we won in the sense that the opponent that we fought against or didn't fight against for such a long time is no longer in existence in its previous form. On the other hand, that happened in 1989, 1990. What have we been spending on since? Second of all, it doesn't follow that because your victory occurred that the spending that was there was the most efficient spending. That is by no means a guaranteed conclusion. I think Eisenhower, of course, was in favor, as the speech says. Eisenhower was in favor of the armament of the United States. He was in favor of the Cold War, but he still reached this conclusion that it was having all these other effects on society. I would also challenge anyone to produce an economic study that shows, despite the spinoffs, the technological spinoffs that David refers to, that is the most efficient way to create technological innovation. Every single economic study that has been done shows the opposite, that military spending is a clunky, inefficient way to do these things. Yes, the benefits that come from them are fantastic, but they would be more rapidly developed if they were done outside of the context.
You're talking about spinoff technologies and so on. There,
sure. I mean, as a researcher, I'll say it's still hard. If you go into the National Archives today and try to pull documents about satellite technology from 50, 60 years ago, some of that stuff is still classified. It's insane that we developed that technology with the level of classification that we did, and that hindered its development. It did not help it. All of the secrecy, all of the excess spending that happened because it took place in a military context would have, by every single economic study that's been done, been more efficient had it been done in the private sector. So it is, in fact, the military-industrial complex is, in fact, an economic distortion of the principles of a free market. It's one that the American right tends to embrace, unlike other market distortions. But it is a market distortion. We should call it as such.
So you make it an efficiency argument in response to our caller, David, in Orlando. Andrew Bacevich, what do you say to the formula that our Florida caller has raised? It worked. We won. What do you want?
Well, it's a vast oversimplification for why the Cold War ended the way it did. I think you can make a strong argument that it wasn't that we won, but that they lost, that the manifest deficiencies of Marxism, Leninism simply caused the Soviet Empire to crumble. But I think more than that, Eisenhower himself, I think, would be appalled at the notion that such an enormous and complex, costly, and yes, morally costly conflict, such as the Cold War, could be dismissed with such a sort of a cavalier verdict. I think Eisenhower was insisting in his speech that we remain sensitive to all of these ancillary costs and complications that were being piled up as a consequence of the Cold War policies that he himself had helped to put in place.
Our caller also raised the cost of social spending during that time. I want to look at that. Of course, the Eisenhower phrase, the Eisenhower perspective in that farewell speech still echoing today, and not just on the outside. Here's U.S. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, and he was speaking here just last May at the Eisenhower Library.
Does the number of warships we have and are building really put America at risk when the U.S. battle fleet is larger than the next 13 navies combined, 11 of which are our partners and allies? Is it a dire threat that by 2020 the United States will only have 20 times more advanced stealth fighters than China? These are the kinds of questions Eisenhower asked as Commander-in-Chief. They are the kind of questions I believe he would ask today.
And there's the Secretary of Defense under George W. Bush and Barack Obama speaking. But I want to roll back the tape one more time to Eisenhower's speech itself 50 years ago today. He was worried about the economy, about our politics and democracy, about our spiritual life, he said, but he also brought it down to the very real kind of bottom line of national spending and the idea of spending that would spend on military or perhaps anything else today at the expense of American children and grandchildren tomorrow. Here's that piece of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech.
We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
The insolvent phantom of tomorrow. So James Ledbetter, was he worried about our, you know, immortal souls or about our national bottom line, our balanced budget?
Both. Eisenhower had a lifelong belief in the power of a balanced budget and a lifelong fear that the United States would turn into the phrase that he frequently used, a garrison state. And this is why I agree with Dr. Bacevich that to simply say we won would not be sufficient for Eisenhower. He recognized that at any point during the Cold War, we could have won if we decided to completely mobilize our economy the way that we did in World War II, if we decided to curtail civil liberties. Winning was not really that hard. Winning and preserving democracy was extremely challenging. And I think while I certainly would not argue that the United States has turned itself into a garrison state in the intervening half century, I do think that the threat escalation that took place after September 11th has caused a lot of backsliding in the form of civil liberties. You look at the torture at Abu Ghraib, the Guantanamo situation where innocent people have been kept without any kind of due process for several years. The Blackwater incidents where apparently, you know, civilians were killed with no really legal recourse because of the murky areas in which they operate. All of this, I think, would have troubled Eisenhower in this very aspect of spirituality. And if I may, because this is Martin Luther King Day that we're talking about, in 1963, Martin Luther King said this. This is well before the escalation of Vietnam, by the way. He said, millions of citizens are deeply disturbed that the military-industrial complex too often shapes national policy, but they do not want to be considered unpatriotic. This is the same problem we face today. It is extremely difficult for any elected officials, let alone the President of the United States, to criticize the military-industrial complex publicly because they will be attacked for being soft on defense, soft on the military, whether communism exists or not. Well, so this mechanism is clearly self-perpetuating and can attach itself to whatever we consider to be the threat of the day, and that is dangerous.
And I want to come to that. I guess you're saying Eisenhower looking not just for victory in the Cold War even, but the quality of the society, our society that ended up winning. Let's get another caller here. Len in Springfield, Vermont. Len, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I was an employee of a private contractor, there's that word, for a company in Southern Connecticut that made helicopters. I'm sure we all know who that was. Back in the 80s, they partnered with Boeing on a product called the RAH-66, which was an attack reconnaissance helicopter. And my observations are this. We spent approximately $18 billion over a period of 20 years for three aircraft that actually don't fly. I think only one is capable of flying. And when I made some comments to the effect, that effect, I was promptly fired. Any comments?
Wow. I guess you were fighting the tide there, Lynn. Andy, there's another voice from inside, you know, who worked at in certainly that's part of the military industrial complex, or was.
Oh, I feel like we're talking about the WikiLeaks cables where they come out and everybody says, didn't we already know that? I mean, we know this. Mm-hmm. We know that the level of waste is mind-boggling. I mean, we're about to or just have canceled the Marine EFV program, a new amphibious vehicle. Gates killed the F-22. The F-35 is another fighter aircraft.
For all the billions that have gone into these.
Unbelievably, mm-hmm. over what the projected price was going to be. Again, I think it to go back to the speech, and James Ledbetter said earlier, in some respects, this is an admission of failure on Eisenhower's part. I think that's right. An admission of failure rendered on the eve of his departure
from public life.
That mm-hmm. he thought that he could set in motion policies that he could control. He's now saying, as he departs office, I can't control them. And he says, again, back to that mm-hmm. phrase, only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry mm-hmm. can mm-hmm. do things. Mm-hmm. Well, only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can demand that these kind of cost overruns stop, that someone be held accountable, that people get fired. But
there's an attitude that surrounds that sleep, perhaps. Here's a comment from the website saying, from Steve in Nashville, he says, hearing Ike makes me mourn the loss of the Republican Party I was raised in. He says, I wonder how current Republicans, or Democrats for that matter, would respond to this kind of statement. I guess he means if this speech were made today, I suspect they would either distance themselves or respond with scorn.
Intriguingly, I think I'm waiting for the so-called Tea Party movement to discover its anti-imperial, anti-war roots. I understand the Tea Party to be the latest manifestation of a really rich tradition of American populism. And American populists have always been anti-war and anti-interventionist. To the extent that the Tea Party movement is coming to be a significant presence in our politics, when that movement awakens to its roots in the anti-war, anti-military part of our tradition, then we may find a Republican Party that is able to ask the sort of questions that Eisenhower asked in his day.
Let's hear from Marguerite in Boston. Marguerite, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Tom, Susan Eisenhower, the general and president's granddaughter, mm-hmm. has said openly on TV stations last year that her grandfather's original phrase had been military-industrial congressional complex, because we can understand that thinking, because the Congress has voted so quickly and easily for all of our 8 unnecessary wars since World War II. Even Hillary Clinton voted for the Iraq War, even though she must have known that the same men who were surrounding George Bush then in his cabinet, the same men who had asked her husband in 1998 to invade Iraq, and he refused.
Marguerite, our time is short. Let us pick it straight up, if we may. James Ledbetter, what about that word congressional? Was it originally in the phrase? And how did the President Eisenhower think about the role of Congress in this complex picture?
There is no extant draft of the speech that contains the phrase military-industrial-congressional complex. This, I don't know if Susan Eisenhower saying this. I'm going to see her this week. I will ask her about that. But I do not believe that phrase ever existed in any draft. We have a memo that seems to be the first piece of written history of this speech, written in late October 1960, that refers to a war-based industrial complex. It seems very illogical that they would then attach congressional only to take it out. Having said that, there's no question that Eisenhower and his advisors considered Congress to be a critical part of this self-perpetuating military-industrial machine. The entire politics of Eisenhower's second term was all about conflicts with Congress over presumably an unnecessary or largely trumped up military spending.
Did Eisenhower, did Ike ever say another word about this? We have a question here online.
Yes,
from Ron,
he did.
Says, you know, why didn't he speak up if he was so felt this so strongly during the remaining years of his life until 69? You know, there was plenty of intervention during that time. Why not then?
Yep. That's a very good question. Eisenhower retired shortly after giving this speech to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and spent a couple years writing a memoir, so that took up a lot of his time. He did give a couple of speeches. He and his brother gave oral history interviews on this topic. But frankly, by the time Eisenhower died in 1969, I think he thought it was best to not publicly criticize the spending that was going on by Democratic presidents, even though it is clear from the documents that we do have that he thought that much of what he talked about was coming to pass, as did his brother Milton.
Andrew Bacevich, we've just got a minute here. Where do you look now? If Eisenhower might have been disturbed at what's developed since, if he might have been, where do you look now? Right, left, center for this citizenry's answer to our circumstance?
Well, I'm pessimistic, but since my most recent book came out, the subtitle, America's Path to Permanent War, I've been struck by the number of emails I have received from serving officers not of my acquaintance. And I'm wondering, hoping perhaps,
as a former
that from within
officer
the
yourself.
Officer Corps, we will begin to hear some insistence that the first order critical questions actually get asked.
Maybe not from a former five-star general this time, but from the officer corps that's been deployed in...
From the captains and the majors who are on their third and their fourth and their fifth combat tours.
Andrew Bacevich, 1969 graduate of West Point, author of Washington Rules, The Limits of Power. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And James Ledbetter, author of Unwarranted Influence, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the Military-Industrial Complex. It was great to hear from you today on the 50th anniversary of that speech, Jim. Thank you very much for taking the time for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for your thoughts. Thanks for being as informed as we can be. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.